there was no digital minister in Taiwan before, so I get to write my own job description. And so I wrote a prayer poem, really. It's very short. I'll just recite it here. It goes like this. When we see Internet of Things, let's make it an Internet of Beings. When we see virtual reality, let's make it a shared reality. When we see machine learning, let's make it collaborative learning. When we see user experience, let's make it about human experience. And whenever we hear that a singularity is near, let us always remember the plurality is here.
Welcome to How to Save Democracy, the podcast where we look at the relationship between humanity and democracy and try to figure out how to rebuild it. I'm John.
And I'm Omazin. And for this episode, we're going to look to a place where actually the relationship between humanity and democracy has got better over the last 10 years, which isn't the picture of most of the world. A place that has actually got stronger and stronger, where trust in government has gone from 9%, wait for it, to above 70%.
In summer 2024, I arranged for Audrey Tung, former digital minister of Taiwan, to come to the UK, and I hosted her at The Conduit. We're going to listen into that conversation and draw out some of the key lessons, contrasting what happened in Taiwan with what's happened in other places, and use that to see what could be done differently. That moment of the Sunflower Revolution, the protest moment, maybe just tell us a bit more about the URL that popped up on the screen, budget.g0v.tw, was a real thing. So please.
Yeah, so we like to say that we're not protesters, we're demonstrators. Protesters manufacture counterpower, and demonstrators manufacture alternate power. So G0V, starting 2012, is the systemic movement that look at all the government websites, which is something that GOV.TW, and make better shadow government websites at something that G0V.TW. So just by changing O to a zero, you get into the shadow government that is built by open source civic technologists, and that always works in a way that is free of copyright, that the government is basically shamed into merging it back. And the best thing about such GovZero experiments is that a lot of it actually came from the Korea Public Service. It is the actual section chiefs and so on participating in our hackathons pseudonymously. And only when they really saw that this is a better way that the public can see the budget, co-create a dictionary together, make better contact tracing systems during the pandemic, make better distribution systems of masks during the pandemic, and many other things, better way to collaboratively fact check and so on, do the government can then say, okay, because it's free of copyright, let's just make a digital public infrastructure. And so this has been for the past 10 years, a lot of very active, what we call the social sector in Taiwan, has been able to very actively set agenda for digital infrastructure in Taiwan. And so that Occupy movement was kind of the peak experience for all of us, because as many of you know, there was like many Occupy movements before 2014 in Taiwan, but very rare did it actually reach a place where the head of the parliament actually said, okay, it sounds very reasonable. After 3 weeks of nonviolent Occupy, those 500,000 people on the street and many more online managed to agree on a very coherent set of policy demands. So, okay, I'll accept, and that's it, right? So it's one of very rare successful occupied that's then institutionalized the kind of facilitation, the kind of crowdsourced agenda setting that we demonstrated during those 3 weeks.
Yeah, I see two main powerful things in what she said right now. One is the demonstrator part of the movement, of the Occupy movement in Taiwan. And second is the political leadership. I want to start by the first one because it's really this fundamental difference between protester and demonstrator that she's pointing at. And I think most protest movements and Occupy movements and the Tunisian revolution were unified against a system that was dysfunctioning, oppressive. And so it's easy to unite people against one single enemy. But I think it's kind of revolutionary and very visionary, and adding those two words together to bring a solution and an alternative to the current system. And I think this is why it was successful.
So they created the space for the politics to move into.
Yes. And then it comes the second point, where the political leadership was not violently repressing the movement as they did everywhere else. In Tunisia, people were shot by the police and got killed. An Occupy movement, people were taken out of the street and arrested.
Right.
But here, the political leadership was open to see that there is an alternative, that these people are coming with a solution and that they need to listen to them.
So two really fundamental differences. The action from outside was to create the space for politics to move into rather than to attack the politics. And from inside, the leadership was to step into that space rather than reject that space.
Absolutely. No, there is this very delicate place where there is this maximum tension between the protester / demonstrator movement that are gaining attention and they're really pushing the political leadership at its limit. And the political leadership seeing that they lost power and the trust of the public. And so what do they do? In most situations, the violence happened to repress this new power that was coming up from the people, right? But in this case, you know, they didn't try to co-opt the movement either. And it makes me think of what happened in the Tunisian Revolution, where the social movement was at the end of the day co-opted by political parties because they didn't have this vision. They didn't have this new proposal, this alternative system. And so slowly but surely, political parties were more structured, even though not really structured to govern after the dictatorship was taken down. They had more power, more connections to the regime. So kind of a conversation started with the regime, but kind of excluding the people because they didn't have any leader to represent them and no really idea, new idea, so how to handle this period. And so there is this delicate movement where a delicate moment in time that, you know, the movement can totally lose in front of the existing power. And in Tunisia, I think one of the failures of this transition was that people who went to the streets were really, you know, didn't have the tools, didn't have the collective capacity to bring this new vision. That made it super weak in front of others who had another vision. And so in protest movements, in revolution, you need to come up with a vision. Otherwise, others will take it from you, will use their own vision to force it on you, kind of.
So we're going to paint that timeline a little bit to start us off. So the budget website came in 2012.
That's correct.
And that was the GovZero movement, as it was known, starting to organize outside of government.
So basically every 2 months, we will hold a physical hackathon, about 200 people or so. And we meet in the National Academy. So the idea is that we need to find places that are credibly neutral, that are above any party politics, any ministers and so on, like purely social sector place. And it just so happens that Taiwan has this idea of a National Academy that only reports to the president, and the president doesn't have control over its research direction. And so we were able to just keep meeting there every 2 months for more than 10 years now.
And so 2012, these websites that have forked the government, I've heard you use that phrase. Yeah,
fork the government. Fork means, steering it in a different direction. And always with the hope to merge it back.
So demonstrate, not protest, and fork, not the government. And so we start there, 2012. So the momentum's kind of building. 2014 comes. And what triggered that moment?
So in 2014, the parliament was at the time trying to fast track through in 30 seconds a trade deal with Beijing, and that would open up a lot of the service industry, including the then very new 4G core infrastructure to the likes of Huawei and ZTE and so on. So the conversations that people here have almost 10 years after that, we had that in 2014. And so it's not just the telecom industry, but also publishing and basically all the service and trade. And so the GovZero people helped to code up some tools that says, you know, if you just enter your company's registration number or the name of your company, it shows exactly how the CSSTA, the Cross-Strait Service Trade Agreement, affects you. And then you can join one of the 20 NGOs around the occupied parliament to talk about things from an environmental perspective, from a labor perspective, from a consumer protection perspective, from a cybersecurity perspective, however you want. And then every day we take this group selfie, this snapshot, because everything is live streamed, just like we're being live streamed now, and transcribed and translated and so on. So instead of it diverging over time, it actually converged day after day. We would read what people were able to agree roughly with each other. We call it rough consensus to live with such a agreement the previous day and what remains to be deliberated. So no matter how soon or how late you join, there are still some points to contribute to the deliberation.
So I want to draw out here how different this protest moment, the Sunflower Revolution, the Occupy movement in Taiwan, is from in its operation from some others. And one of my thought experiments to illustrate this would be about Extinction Rebellion in the UK. And when XR started, it was incredibly popular, right? It's hard to remember now, but my mum nearly went to Waterloo Bridge, right? And my mum is not a Waterloo Bridge woman. But in that moment, the demands of XR included a citizens' assembly on climate policy. And they wanted that assembly to be legally binding and by 2035 for how Britain would reach net zero. I won't go into the detail, but actually a citizens' assembly was commissioned in the UK. Not many people even know this, which illustrates my point. A citizens' assembly was commissioned by six select committees of parliament. And my thought experiment is, if you contrast that with GovZero, what these guys were doing, they were actually around the parliament, not perfectly, but while protesters were occupying the parliament, people were having the kinds of discussions that should and could have been happening in the parliament outside. They were doing the politics that they were wanting. So my thought experiment is, what actually happened was, because the citizens' assembly that was commissioned was not quite what XR had asked for, they basically decided to ignore it.
Big mistake.
And my thought experiment is, what if they had chosen to follow that citizens' assembly? What if each meeting of the assembly, there were three, I think, meetings of the assembly, what if they'd set the dates for their rebellions, for the big protests, on those dates to draw attention to the citizens' assembly, to say, this isn't perfect, but we need more of this. This is the direction we want to go. I wonder if that might have conducted energy into that process that could have shown a new way forward, in the same way as the GovZero gang, by equipping people to have these meetings or outside the parliament, they sort of validated the occupation of the parliament by doing that.
Mm-hmm. So if they have been more pragmatic, if they would have accepted the situation as it is and not try to implement from the beginning their vision and impose it, like accept that maybe the situation, the political leadership was not ready yet for that, but see the citizen assembly, as imperfect as it is, as a first step, instead of like, okay, this is a no-go.
Right. It's almost like a yes and rather than a no. And look, I'm hesitant with this a little bit, because I don't want to... Hindsight is always 20/20, but I think it's useful to draw out the contrast between the way Extinction Rebellion happened and the way the Sunflower Revolution in Taiwan happened. There was this participation that showed and demonstrated and lived and said yes, and we can do more of this, rather than a kind of a a demand and then a failure.
Mm. Would that be like the contrast between an idealist and a pragmatic person or a group? Like an idealist would have this idea and want to implement it exactly as it is in an utopia. And then the pragmatic person, a group, would say, okay, I have this idea, this beautiful vision. It's still an utopia, but I have to deal with a reality. And so any step towards this idea, realizing, making this idea concrete, is relevant. And I take it and I accept it and I move forward with it.
Something like that. I think I hesitate because I consider myself to be an idealist more than a pragmatist. But I think maybe I'd describe Audrey as a radical pragmatist.
Mm-hmm.
We're starting to build this kind of muscle of developing these things. 2014 comes and the trade bill, there's an attempt to rush through the trade bill. That triggers this protest moment. At this point, you're
demonstration.
Part... Demonstration.
Sorry.
Busted. And at this point, you're part of GovZero.
Yeah.
So I started very, very early. I joined GovZero 2012. At the time, I was working with Apple on Siri technology and with Oxford University Press on empowering the low-resource languages, such as it's Zulu or the other languages, to crowdsource dictionaries so Siri can speak those languages. And so naturally, because in Taiwan, nowadays we have 20 national languages, 16 indigenous nations, 42 language variations. So not all of them have the same degree of support like traditional Mandarin when it comes to dictionary building. And so a lot of the early GovZero work is actually on forking the official dictionary to add in modern words, contemporary words, and so on. So that was my first projects in 2013 when I joined. And so in 2014, what's really interesting is that this kind of crowdsourcing, this kind of facilitative conversation and so on that we practice over 2 years really found its place coupling with the dynamic facilitation, the open space technology, the nonviolence communicators, and so on, the face-to-face facilitative people. And so unlike many other Occupy, where the face-to-face facilitative people and the online communications people were really two different camps. During the 2014 Occupy, we kind of fused together. We all learned the art of face-to-face dynamic facilitation, and the facilitators all learned the art of online organization, basically. And so we became kind of the same people. So after that, there was a mayoral election at the end of 2014. And so all the mayors that did support, crowdsource agenda setting, open government, civic participation, did get elected, sometime to their surprise, without preparing an inauguration speech. And all the mayoral candidates that did not support it did not get elected. And so the wind really shifted. And then it's then up to us, right, to determine what to do. Now we have mayors that run with open government as their platform, with participatory budgeting, with citizens' initiatives, with reverse mentorship. But they also have no idea, how to properly work with people. They just, have this pre-commitment. And so we, the reverse mentors, are the people who are under 35 years old. And each cabinet member at the time were kind of tasked with finding at least one person under 35 to mentor them in the art of this new communication style. And so I was 33 at the time. So I got recruited into the cabinet as a reverse mentor to Minister Jacqueline Tsai, who is in charge of regulation for the cyberspace, basically. And so we did a bunch of stuff together, UberX, Airbnb, crowdfunding, all the interesting things around 2015, using the V-Taiwan process that builds this kind of bridging sentiments across polarization. And so that's, long story short, after 2 years serving as the young reverse mentor, then I turned 35, I'm too old to be a young advisor, so I got promoted to a full cabinet minister.
Obviously, right. So we've gone career trajectory in 4 years, hacker to mentor to minister, so in that moment, well let's bring it up to 2020 and sort of for me the kind of pinnacle of the story.
No idea, right? It's a very uneventful year. Well, we started buildings and institutionalizing such relationship muscles. And within each and every ministry, we have a team called participatory team, and with participation officers or POs. And they were trained in the art of facilitation, of citizen engagement, of civic tech, and things like that. And all that relationship muscle, all that 30 or so ministries horizontal network, really got into action in 2020 when we started setting up this daily system where people can call a hotline 1922 and ask to their heart's content what's really going on with this pandemic. So in Taiwan, we discovered that we need, for example, to ration out masks very quickly. I think it was February 2020 when we started having this open API that anybody can see with a civic tech tool. Actually, there's hundreds of such tools, how to navigate to your nearby pharmacy, how to get some rationed mask and things like that. There's some communication efforts. We crowdsourced very cute memes. There was a spokes dog, a Shiba Inu, very, very cute. And she would just put her paw to her mouth and say, you know, wear a mask to protect your face against your dirty unwashed hands or something like that, which is, you know, completely circumvents this, you know, aerosol debate or whatever, right? It's just a very viral meme that people would link mask wearing to hand washing and so on. So then this broad listening, it's not broadcasting, this broad listening network really paid dividends. For example, not long after we started rationing our mask, there was a young boy, 10 years old, calling 1922 the hotline saying, you're rationing our mask in schools, that's great, but all I got was pink ones, which is not great. All the other boys in my class has blue ones, like standard medical grade masks, but all I got was pink ones. I don't want to wear pink to school, I'll get bullied or something like that. And so we need to handle that fast, because if we do not do that, if we just, you know, after this goes viral and the Minister of Education goes out and say bullying is bad, it actually makes it worse, right? So we need to handle this in 24 hours. And so all the participation officers huddled together. And so there was a great idea from the Ministry of Health and Welfare's participation officer, which we turned into action. The very next 2 p.m. press conference, everybody wore pink. And the health minister wore the pink mask and like looking very hip. And so basically, regardless of gender, everybody wore pink. And so the Instagram, Facebook, whatever avatars of all the trending brands all turned pink. And so the very next day when the boy comes to class, only he has the, you know, the most hip color, the most sought after color. All right. And so we, that's the idea of humor over rumor, the idea that it's not debunking that fixes this polarization. It is pre-bunking. This is anticipating the energy that will go into polarization and shifting that energy in a kind of Aikido sort of way into something that's humorous, that is goes viral.
And just to underline one more thing in this, that the three design principles that were, I believe, were publicly announced, right?
Yeah, it's called fast, fair, and fun, right? So the triple F, that was our counter-pandemic response, and it applies to everything, not just masks, but contact tracing, vaccination. We have a like global, national vaccination scoreboard that just like soccer games, you know, displays the score of each age bracket's preferences. And so, for example, people in their 70s, in their 60s, because they read some reports from Europe around AstraZeneca, they don't prefer AstraZeneca. They would say, we prefer Moderna, for example. And there are people in certain age brackets, like 30 years old or something, they really root for the local team, the homebrew, the Medigen. But there are people who swear Medigen is, you know, toxic, and they will only get BNT and whatever. So I got all four brands, just to make a point. But anyway, so the point is that we knew there's going to be an anti-vax polarization attack down the road. But instead of debunking that, we turned that energy into civic participation, basically my vaccine better than your vaccine, kind of friendly competition. And so because of that, Taiwan does not have an anti-vax political faction. Everybody got vaccinated, but still to this day, people would believe that only the one that they got works, the other ones are fake or something like that.
There's so much in Taiwan's COVID response that is just like, I mean, we laugh, right? But it worked.
Yeah.
Like this, I still can't believe really that I'm one of the only people who seems to tell this story. that fast, fun and fair, the pre-bunking, not debunking, the humor over rumor, these kinds of approaches really worked. Like Taiwan had the second lowest death rate anywhere in the world. That the country as a whole never went into lockdown. And trust in government built through that process. So the economy was doing better, the trust was doing better. And at the core of it, I think, is this idea that the government trusted its citizens. That the government sought to tap into the ideas and energy and resources of everyone in the country to be part of a national team response rather than trying to do it for them or to them, rather than seeing citizens as something to be managed. They saw their citizens as a resource to be tapped.
And I think this is unique. I mean, I would love to see that in more places in the world, but I want to acknowledge the political leadership there, because seeing citizens as resources, trusting collective intelligence, understanding that it's really a humanity crisis, I was going to say, and that they don't have the solution, and they need everyone to come up with, you know, the answer is pretty unique. And I'm wondering how we can get politicians to embrace more that vision, you know, that trust in their citizens.
This is exactly the question, I think. And that's where I took the conversation next, actually, because I think sometimes it can be easy to think of Taiwan as just another planet, right? Like, and to say, well, this could never happen anywhere else. And so I put that question to Audrey. Could it happen anywhere else?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of pandemic response, we're second to New Zealand, so obviously it's not just Taiwan. But I think, in more generally speaking, it does require, as I mentioned, the relationship muscles, right? It does require the public service trusting the citizens, because to give no trust is to get no trust. And so it does take somebody to trust the citizen first before some of the citizens trust back. But the trust level was really low in 2014. The approval rate to the administration back then was 9%. And so, like, anything the administration says at a time, automatically people would just say, you know, well, we'll have none of this. And then if you ask a random person on the street, like, whether you will get democratic agency, like, nothing about you without you or something like that, they're like, of course not, right? It did take a lot of time and institutionalization and hard work for the public service to start trusting bit by bit the citizens. And it does take technology, right? Technology that highlights the bridges instead of the polarization, to show the public service that it does actually surface the signal, not just the voice. It actually saves your time instead of wastes your time when you engage the public in this particular way. And so I think in Taiwan, what we have demonstrated is that it does take, you know, in 2018, it was still just 20% trust level. It took us like almost 8 years to reach 60%, right? So my president, Dr. Tsai Ing-wen, graduated with almost 70% trust level, all like pan-partisan, which is very good. But it's like every year we just dialed the trust from the government to the citizen way up, and then maybe 10% of citizens trust back a little bit.
I want to go back to this powerful sentence: to give not trust is to get no trust. And I'm wondering where it starts. Someone needs to be the first, you know, to give this trust, right? In this atmosphere of suspicion. And yeah, and again, we can think of it as like this unique place. But at the same time, if you, the most powerful, give that trust, right?
I think that's right. Like, and the danger, I think, in this moment is that we're in, and I think what's so powerful about that articulation, to give no trust is to get no trust, it's actually a quote from the Tao Te Ching, from Lao Tzu. And what it tells us is that it's a cycle. It's a reciprocal. And so if you give no trust, you get less trust. And then when you trust people less, government trusts people less, people trust government trusts people less. But it's also possible to reverse that cycle. And it's possible to do that anywhere. So that the first acts of government putting trust in people begins to turn that the other way. And I think that's what you can see from examples around the world where just the first experiments with a citizens' assembly, like in Ireland in one of our other episodes, or in Norway, a similar thing, or a big participatory budgeting effort in the city of Paris, or a climate assembly in the city of Brussels. Like, these sorts of things begin to create a different relationship. And anywhere in the world, it can begin from there.
So I just want to underline this because there is a sort of an instinct to sort of project onto Taiwan as this sort of deeply solidarity nation in the face of an oppressor. And
by this year, of course, yes.
But
not 10 years ago.
Yeah, and just to like refer to some of those numbers that you put out. So trust in government was at 9% in 2014.
Yeah, 20 in 2018.
And this year in the UK, we're on about 20%. To give you a sense of like, so we are actually double where they were at the beginning. On some, you may have different data. No, the latest OECD data was 20%. We're starting at a slightly higher baseline, even with what's happened here. And then this point about kind of a sort of singular nation. But you're saying 20 different languages. There is some deep polarization there, right? So we're not. We're not talking about.
Well, there's a lot of if you go to political rallies, for example, if you go to the ruling party's rally for a presidential election, you will find that none of them are waving the national flag. They're all waving this green island flag or rainbow flag or something. And it's actually at the opposition party, the KMT, where they wave the national flag. So it's very divided in terms of even the English name of our country. They will give you very different answers. And so anyway, but all these did not prevent the depolarizing work because we both, on both sides, and now with TPP, we have three parties, none of which have majority in the parliament, but all three parties doubles down on the democratic process and open parliament and citizen participation and so on. So it becomes a race to the top. Once the career public service know that they have the social sector as the ally to just foster this kind of work, then the political parties, the ministers, the MPs, and so on, they can compete, of course, on even more transparency, even more accountability. But then the ideology stop being, you know, the stopping point to stop the people from, you know, participating meaningfully.
So it becomes a race to the top. And I think this point really stands out. I mean, one of the most striking realizations I had when I joined the Tunisian government as an advisor to the Minister of Finance was the deep distrust high-level state officials had towards civil society organizations. And I hadn't fully understood just how deep that suspicion or even fear ran until I met with a member of the European Parliament who served on the delegation for relations with the Maghreb countries. She mentioned that during Ben Ali's dictatorship, Tunisia was the only country that sent the names of civil society activists and political opponents to Interpol, labeling them as terrorists. Can you imagine? Looking at Tunisia under dictatorship and Taiwan under democracy, I've come to see the relationship between civil society organizations and public servants as a kind of thermometer for the health of a democracy. The more trust there is between them, the healthier the system, I think, tends to be. To repair our relationship to democracy, we need to start looking at the relationship between civil society organizations and civil servants, I think.
I totally agree. I think the relationship between civil service and civil society is another of these absolutely fundamental relationships where the trust has to be rebuilt. It speaks also to this underlying philosophy that is there in Audrey's work, and that she'd actually, when I brought her over to the UK, had just put out into the world in the form of a book co-authored with Glenn Whale called Plurality. And I decided at this point to steer her into talking about that.
So let's zoom out again a little bit to the underlying philosophy here, right? And this is the book Plurality. The only 20 odd copies that are in the UK at the moment are at the back of the room and have all been signed. Not that there's a massive sales plug going on here or anything. This isn't just about there's a story and there's actually an underlying philosophy, a mindset that you're now kind of working with Glenn and putting out into the world as an offer of something to step into.
Yeah, it's like 1 kilogram of distilled wisdom over the past 10 years of work. The idea, really simply put, is that singularity may be near and nearer. There's a new book that says Singularity is Nearer by Creswell. But every time that we see a technological transformation, we can ask like whether this technology is in the service of the plurality, that is the diversity that collaborates around us, or whether it is a technocratic force that centralizes more power to, you know, this flying spaghetti, Shoggoth, AGI, whatever, in the sky, right? So to every technological transformation, we can ask that question. And so in Taiwan, we've been consistently asking that question, like whether we're developing AI as assistive technologies like this, assistive technology, very transparent, and also that I can fix it when it has bias, it improves my dignity, it's not transmitting photons to the cloud and back to my retina with advertisement pop-ups or things like that, right? So the idea really is that AI should be assistive intelligence, it should not be technocratic, and plurality or collaborative diversity stems from the radical kind of conflict that Taiwan brings, like earthquakes. There's 3 failed earthquakes somewhere in Taiwan every day. But because that we anticipate that there's earthquakes out of this tectonic conflicts between the Eurasian and the Pacific plates. So we work on resilience, we work on the building codes, we work on the societal preparedness that turns this conflict into co-creation. So it's like harnessing the fire, the explosion, right? Like before, when we see fire on the ground, we put it out. But now we see fire on the ground and we drill it, knowing that there's energy underneath. And so the idea is to turn that conflict into co-creative energy. And there's a lot of ways that the digital technology can help the face-to-face, the in-person, the facilitative, the community sectors, the neighborhoods, to make that happen. And so if we look at traditional Mandarin words for digital or shu wei, it actually also means plural, shu wei, like several, more than one, digits like 10, right? So a minister of digital affairs is also minister for plurality, and this is where the philosophy stems from. It is digital in the service of collaborative diversity.
I mean, once again, we've got huge ideas here, right? Mm. Like this concept of assistive intelligence rather than artificial general intelligence, the giant spaghetti squid in the sky. I mean, Audrey has some good images as well, right? But I think that juxtaposing those two possibilities, the idea of using technology to, again, tap into the ideas and energy and resources of citizens to enable collaboration, to enable human experience, not user experience. It's such a powerful thing to do to juxtapose that with the where things are going at arguably going at the moment, where when you start from a lack of trust in people, when you see the role of government as being to sort of manage and or deliver for people, you end up with this kind of centralized power that is crushing. I find it so inspiring to see and hear Audrey talking about this. It's like seeing people as citizens, as capable contributors, means that you use technology entirely differently. The starting point is how do we make the most of what people are capable of and assist them to do it, rather than how do we supersede.
Private sector is guilty. No, to be honest, like when you think of it, our technologies today are not designed to see people as citizens, but mostly as consumers. As people who need to buy and be addicted to the products they buy. And the more addicted, the more, you know, we can buy them things instead of seeing them as a resource for intelligence and for moving humanity forward. And I think that's our curse today, because the AI is not designed by visionaries like Audrey, but by people who want to extract more from us. How do we change that?
Follow Taiwan, but citizens, not consumers. You're not going to get any disagreement on that from me.
And just to underline it, I mean, the metaphor of the Eurasian and the plates crashing into one another is pretty powerful, right? And I relate to this very deeply. So in my work, I talk about three stories of the individual in society in this moment: the subject story, the consumer story, and the citizen story. The subject story, the right thing to do as you're told, because the God-given few know best. The consumer story, the right thing to do is to pursue self-interest, because that will add up to collective interest. The citizen story, get involved, because all of us are smarter than any of us, and that's how. And that's, and you draw on an analogous light, I suppose, seeing the same thing through a different lens. So maybe you could set out how you see the sort of that trio.
I'll just continue the story, right? The idea of the two tectonic plates bumping into each other is also the story of the tip of Taiwan, almost 4,000 meters high, Yushan, rising up to the sky half a centimeter every year because of these tectonic plates. And so in a sense, the citizen story says that if we have the capacity to face the conflicts and just entertain in our mind the plurality of viewpoints, I'm non-binary, which means that I don't see half of the people as closer to me and half of people necessarily farther away from me. So in 2016, in my HR form, in the gender field, I filed not applicable, and in the party field, also not applicable. And so I do not have any political party affiliation, but in a sense, I'm pan-partisan, that if there is a party that I feel that I really can't understand why would people feel this way, I would always think it's my problem, it's not their problem. So I should spend time on an ethnographic or just hanging out with them until I can really see things from their perspective. And so I think this actively seeking to balance different viewpoints and so on, that is also plurality, and that is the citizen story. Because if you participate as an active citizen, you're going to run into people who share some of the worldviews, but also vastly different in some of the other points of the worldviews. And the point here is not to build a bridge so that we can all cross to the other side. It's not that. It's to build a bridge so that we can meet a little bit in the middle to share some stories and then go back, right, to where we came from. And that bridge building, I think, is core to digital democracy.
I would always think it's my problem. It's not their problem. I mean, she says so many things that are full of wisdom, and I would love to stop and meditate at every sentence, almost. I don't know. There we have a political leader who sees conflicts as a possibility to grow by sitting and learning from the differing point. She sees herself as a bridge builder instead of a wall raiser. It is this ability to get close enough to everyone in the room to understand their viewpoint, while being able to take a step back and have a look at the whole room, see the big picture. What can unite everyone? I mean, the common ground, right? And start from there to create understanding. That also means that she is able to build trust with everyone in the room, which is one of the toughest tasks and one hell of a powerful skill to be a leader.
Another, I've heard you also talk about it not as kind of just sort of papering over the differences, but actually drawing the best of all these different views, right?
Yes. And when I say bridge building, I don't mean it in a metaphorical way. I mean it in a very technical way. If you have participated in community notes on X.com, previously known as Twitter, then you probably know that the notes that gets featured as a kind of context check to any viral posts that may be lopsided are the notes that convinces people on both polarities polarized sides. So if people on two very different ideologies both resonate with one note, then that note flows to the top. It is a very different way to sort information instead of just sorting by addictiveness or engagement, however you want to call it. It sorts by how much bridge-making potential it has. And this open source algorithm stems from something that I worked personally on in 2015, the Polis algorithm. The Polis algorithm basically asks people a very simple question, like, for example, on the UberX case. First, we map out the facts that instead of, you know, the very idealistic, abstract sharing economy, gig economy, extractive economy, whatever, exploitative economy, instead of those abstract words, we just say, okay, nowadays in Taiwan, there is an app that a person with driver's license but no professional driver's license can use to meet strangers on their way to work and pick them up and then charging them for it automatically. So this is the fact. And the insurance situation, the registration situation, the metering situation, the surge pricing, these are the facts. Now we map out the facts and then we ask just one simple question to everyone. How do you feel about it? And this is really the key because everybody is an expert in our own feelings. There is no like judgment in terms of feelings. If people feel that UberX is not covering their rural areas very well, then they can say, I feel that the rural areas are not being covered well. And that's like nobody can say that this feeling is right or wrong. It is just their feelings. And so instead of a reply button, there is no reply button. And so there's no flame wars. There is instead, I resonate or I don't resonate with this feeling. And so when you go to the Polis website, all you can say is I resonate, I don't resonate. And then the next feeling comes, the next feeling comes. And at some point, you'll be prompted also to write your own feelings about the UberX thing. And so next to the interface, there is this visualization that shows the clusters, initially very much polarized. You can literally see in the four corners people who identify more with the taxi associations, people who identify more with the UberX app startup ecosystem, whatever, people who identify more with the transportation ministry and the rule of law or whatever, and the people who simply really don't care about all this, but they care about rural coverage very much, right? So all these are like valid. The great thing about this is that this is not a vote, not even a straw poll. So if you have 5,000 people all joining, all voting the same, it doesn't increase the area of the cluster. It only counts as one point because the idea is to surface to the top the bridge makers. First, the bridge makers that build bridges within clusters, and then the bridge makers that manage to build bridges across clusters. For example, there are statements that says surge pricing is fine, but undercutting existing meters hurt the livelihood of the people who drive. So it can only go up and not go down. And that's a unifying sentiment across two islands. And so after 3 weeks of nonviolent communication, people literally see those clusters merging to the middle. And then we have like 10 like high consensus 85% or more statements that we can then read as agenda to Uber, to taxi association on an open live stream multi-stakeholder meeting that says, okay, this sounds very reasonable. Would you like to commit to it? And once they all commit to it, it then becomes law. So since 2015, we've been have a, you know, more than 20 such laws and regulation passed this way, and more than 100 collaborative meetings from citizen initiatives and so on that also use Polis as a bridge-making algorithm.
I think this UberX story is a powerful example showing how the design of a tech platform and the values it is promoting can influence the outcome of dialogue and the real possibility to reach consensus to eventually become law.
And it's all built out of an underlying mindset, right? That plurality is what we want, that we can actually build the best solutions by understanding and seeing all of these different perspectives and finding the consensus out of them. And we can use technology to help find consensus rather than just to deliver goods and services to people more efficiently. So that's so inspiring. And I think the joy in this conversation for me was going, I know that these tools, these approaches are available and are also starting to get picked up.
This conversation is making me understand how important it is to have ethical political leadership ally with good technologists to build the kind of platforms we need to advance democracy. And right, like political leadership cannot be disconnected anymore from technology, and they need to have the, yeah, you know, tech people with them to build the kind of platforms that will eventually become like societal values, right?
It just feels like such a different conversation, doesn't it? It's like it's a conversation about how could this actually create a better world rather than how do we limit the damage that technology does, which feels like it's about the best conversation that anyone can dream of at the moment. This is just another level. And I find that super exciting. Now, the thing is, it's taking too long, but I do believe and see that these sorts of conversations, this sort of work is actually happening all over the world and in many different places. And in the UK right now, there's a new campaign called Our House, which is seeking to use some of these same tools to crowdsource what they're calling a People's Charter for the 21st century democracy, trying to crowdsource what the rules of democracy that might need to change might be from outside of the political system, drawing inspiration from GovZero, using some of the same tools as Taiwan. So this is starting to replicate. At the end of the conversation, I asked Audrey what advice she would give, particularly to the UK, but maybe it's relevant more widely as well.
I think it really is a time for a demonstration, for demonstrators. There's a very clear energy in the air about let's just do something. In the first 100 days, we yesterday had a workshop with the Hard Art community, and there's just huge amount of energy there that says if we manage to build something from the social sector, from the impact communities and so on in the next 100 days, then there's a real chance that it gets institutionalized. And that is the kind of moment that we faced in 2014, in 2016, and we did institutionalize a lot of the stuff. And that then led to this, what we call people first public-private partnership, right? So PPPP, that then defined Taiwanese politics for like the past like 5 years. And so, yeah, I would encourage you to think as a demonstrator and with an eye on perhaps institutionalizing the stuff that you'll be doing in the next coming month.
So one last massive idea from Audrey there, the PPPP, People First Public-Private Partnership, and this invocation to build and to demonstrate. And I think that's such a powerful note to end on. She was talking in summer 2024, just after the election of a new Labour government in the UK. That's the specific context. But these moments keep coming. The moments when things could change dramatically, whether it's a moment in response to riots and protests in a place, if we can have a different model available for a government to step into like they did in Taiwan with that Occupy moment, then things can change very quickly and the work needs to start. And maybe I want to take us back to your comment at the beginning about the two kinds of leadership that are present here. The leadership from the outside of demonstration rather than protest, and the leadership from the inside of being prepared to step into the space that's made.
Powerful. This was How to Save Democracy, the podcast for people who love democracy, but know we've got serious work to do to save it. This episode was hosted by John Alexander and me, Omezin Khalifa, and produced by Joe Barrett. The studio engineer was Kristen Kabuika.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, or if you want to get closer, find us online at howtosavedemocracy.co and sign up to the mailing list. How to Save Democracy is produced in partnership with The Conduit and with Urban MBA, and wouldn't be possible without the financial support of our listeners. We've got big plans, so if you can chip in and help us to make them happen, we'd love to have you on board.